evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, September 24th, 2014. South Sudanese officials say famine has been averted for at least this year.
The last IPC classification indicates that food security across the country has been improving and is expected to continue on a positive trend.
And Qatar pledges more than $85 million to help rebuild Sudan's Darfur region.
This is quite a generous contribution, but I must confess that we need 10 times this amount to make a dent in the situation of Darfur.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. But first we go to Reng. People are slowly trickling back into Reng town in Upper Nile State after deadly clashes last week in the town between government forces and rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. Residents say SPLA is back in control of Reng, but many people are staying away because they fear the town will come under attack again. VOA fellow Michael Atit reports.
32-year primary school teacher Obet Okech says some shops in Reng are open for business again, but others remain closed because the traders are concerned that there might be a new flare-up of violence.
The shops are still closed, but there are those who sell airtime, vegetables, and there are open restaurants. People have begun to arrive to the town, and there is visible movement, but people are still afraid.
Last week, most residents fled Reng town when it came under attack by rebels loyal to former Vice President Riek Machar. A spokesman of the SPLA said 168 rebels and 11 government soldiers were killed in the fighting. Obech says some civilians also died when the town was bombed.
Some bombs fall on civilians' houses and some people get injured, including children. Some of these victims are from Majak.
Obech fled Reng last week. Like many others, he sought refuge in the border town of Joda, just inside Sudan. He came back to Reng yesterday because he says life in Joda is very difficult. People who are sheltering there are in need of shelter, medical care and food, he says.
People fled the town and they did not take anything with them. Now the situation in Joda is bad, and if we come under another attack, many of us will cross the border over to Sudan.
Reng is near several oil fields in Upper Nile State, including the key field of Paluch. Last week, Army spokesman Philip Aguirre said the rebels had attacked the town as part of their plan to seize the country's oil fields, which would give them control of almost all of the South Sudanese government's revenue stream. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit.
South Sudan's agriculture minister says massive emergency aid operations and rain have averted famine in the country. But officials say despite improvement in food security, 1.5 million people, mostly in Greater Upper Nile region, will remain food insecure throughout the end of the year. They say more must be done to ensure the nation's food security, including a peace agreement between the two warring parties. Waki Simon Wudu has more for VOA from Juba.
Speaking at the release of a report, the Integrated Pace Classification, or IPC, on food insecurity, Machar says the study was conducted by his agency earlier this month to clarify food security in South Sudan. Machar dismisses earlier reports by international aid agencies that famine would likely occur later this year in South Sudan and that thousands of people, especially children, would die.
The last IPC classification indicates that food security across the country has been improving and is expected to continue on a positive trend through December 2014, following a seasonal pattern, particularly in Greater Bahr al-Ghazal and Greater Equatorial regions.
Machar says the food security improved in part because South Sudanese were able to plant and harvest their own crops this year.
The normal rainfall, good crops planting and performance, and the start of the green harvest to August have had a positive effect on the seasonal availability of crops, livestock products, fish, and wild foods.
But in the greater Upper Nile region, Machar concedes that thousands of people were displaced from their homes and were unable to grow their own food because of ongoing fighting between government and anti-government forces. Machar warns that if the fighting continues into 2015, food security will be weakened. If that happens, he says, 2.5 million people will experience critical levels of food insecurity from January to March. Earlier this year, aid agencies estimated that 3.5 million people are likely to experience food insecurity this year. The United Nations and other aid agencies have warned that as many as 50,000 children could die by the end of this year due to famine and malnutrition if conditions do not change dramatically in the coming months.
Urges all the actors to scale up their efforts in the coming months in order to prevent further deliberation of food insecurity and malnutrition within the Republic of South Sudan.
Machar also called on the two warring parties to move quickly to resolve the conflict, which would allow hundreds of thousands of displaced people to return to their homes and to grow their own food. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
Still on that story, the International Rescue Committee is expressing concern about how South Sudan will cope with food insecurity in 2015. The IRC says, whereas famine may be averted this year, more must be done to ensure that South Sudanese do not suffer from hunger next year. As Philip Thornaleu reports for VOA from Juba, the IRC warns millions of people could still be food insecure next year.
Wendy Tebek, director of the International Rescue Committee for South Sudan, agrees the integrated phase classification report is a good indication that donor funds have helped avoid famine for millions of South Sudanese. But Tebek says there is no doubt that food shortages still exist in South Sudan.
The key is that we've done it for now, but it's expected to get much worse, and the threat of famine looming, as we often phrase it, is still there and could happen towards December, January, February. Reduced harvests are expected in November, and we don't yet know how those harvests will come out. A lot of people couldn't plant during the fighting and are able to survive now through aid, and through this season typically brings more fish and more vegetables because of the rains.
Tebek says the onset of the dry season, which usually occurs from January through April, could still pose a danger to roughly 1.8 million displaced people. The IPC report released yesterday classifies the severity of food insecurity in countries around the world. The IRC distributes nutritive food and prepositions assistance to displaced persons across South Sudan and other countries in need. Even though the number of estimated food insecure South Sudanese has dropped from 3.7 to 1.5 million this year, Tebek says donors must not relax.
The risk of the good news is that donors and international stakeholders may feel that things are okay. But what we need to remember is just because famine is averted doesn't mean people aren't still hungry. People aren't still much worse off than they were last year. 1.5 million people are still in crisis.
Tebek points out that displaced South Sudanese are still eating only one meal a day, and hundreds of thousands are still living without shelter or much-needed medications. She says the IRC's $800 million budget is addressing those needs. But Tebek says, along with more funding, the IRC needs improved access to rural areas and additional resources, such as more aircraft and all-road terrain vehicles to help the food insecure. Above all, she says, the government and rebels need to reach a permanent peace agreement quickly in order to end food insecurity. For VOA News, I am Philip Thornaleu in Juba.
The Gulf state of Qatar has pledged millions of dollars to rebuild Darfur and provide services to the impoverished people of the western part of Sudan. The $88.5 million grant is the largest so far in a series of donations by the state of Qatar for peace and recovery in Darfur. Ali Azatari represents the United Nations Development Program, or UNDP, in Sudan. He tells VOA fellow Nabil Biagio that the donation from Qatar will go a long way to rebuild Darfur. But he says much more money is needed to reach millions of displaced persons who live in extreme poverty.
There are 15 projects of an immense value to the five states in Darfur, where we will be going into a good number of sectors with the eye to rehabilitate and provide much needed support. This is quite a generous contribution, but I must confess that we need 10 times this amount to make a dent in the situation of Darfur.
When you speak of rehabilitation, what are we talking about exactly in concrete terms?
We are talking about infrastructure, roads, hafirs, which are the water collection points, water and sanitation systems that are in a very poor condition in the areas where IDPs live. We're talking about schools and education, clean energy, clean environment. We're also looking into the more mundane and difficult question of justice and reconciliation and enabling the communities to reach communal peace in Darfur.
You're talking about reconstruction, but have things calm down enough for you to start doing that? I would imagine that requires unhindered access to areas that, you know, you can go to and rebuild.
You have pockets of violence that erupt every once in a while, but there is plenty of work that is being done by the United Nations agencies as well as by the government. So it's not a place that is impossible to work in. It's a place that requires more security, definitely, more stability.
This 88.5 million donation from Qatar, it's directly linked to the Darfur peace agreement that was also signed in Qatar in Doha 2011. And it's part of the Darfur development strategy. So where does it fit in the big plan, which is ultimately peace building and justice?
The big peace plan is the DDPD, which is the Doha Darfur peace document that was signed in Doha. Out of the DDPD, the Darfur development strategy emanated, and the Qatari contribution is contributing towards that. Now, you have to remember that in April 2013, we've held a Darfur donors meeting in Doha, and the needs were about $7.2 billion for Darfur. We've only managed to get about half of that. Now, without a political process that will bring the rebel group into an agreement with the government of Sudan, we will continue to see insecurity in Darfur. And of course, this is a huge risk that we are taking, because what we may build today may be the victim of conflict tomorrow. But we cannot just ignore that the people of Darfur require humanitarian assistance and settlement assistance. Otherwise, we will have millions, close to 7-8 million people in Darfur who are completely destitute. Now, that is not acceptable.
Like you said, the development plan has to be linked with a political process. So there are three components.
Yes.
A reconstruction, governance, and justice. How are you contributing to advocating good governance and justice through your work?
We work with UNAMID very closely, and we work with the Darfur Regional Authority and the government of Sudan. We also work on the reintegration of combatants within these groups that have joined the peace agreement. We work on the justice sector. We have a very active and I think successful program that looks into the roots of conflict in the communities, and we try to manage those successfully, and we are doing that on a day-to-day basis. But again, you need the two to tango. You need communities and you need different groups to want to arrive to a peaceful situation.
That's Ali Azatari, UNDP representative in Sudan. He was speaking to VOA fellow Nabil Biagio from Khartoum earlier today. U.S. President Barack Obama delivered a speech to the U.N. General Assembly this past hour. In it, he called on world leaders to join the U.S.-led coalition, including Arab states, to fight Islamic extremism in the Middle East. Mr. Obama urged his counterparts to work together to make the world a better place for all men, women, and children.
We see the future not as something out of our control, but as something we can shape for the better through concerted and collective effort. We reject fatalism or cynicism when it comes to human affairs. We choose to work for the world as it should be, as our children deserve it to be.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon told the General Assembly that extremist groups are clear threat to international community. He also said human rights are under attack from barrel bombs, beheading and deliberate starvation of civilians and assault on hospitals and UN shelters in aid convoys. The UN General Assembly is expected to adopt a resolution to fight extremism by UN member countries. Mr. Obama also appealed to world leaders to help West African nations contain the spread of the deadly Ebola virus, which has claimed thousands of lives across West Africa. He says his country has dispatched experts to address the situation.
As we speak, America is deploying our doctors and scientists, supported by our military, to help contain the outbreak of Ebola and pursue new treatments. But we need a broader effort to stop a disease that could kill hundreds of thousands, inflict horrific suffering, destabilize economies, and move rapidly across borders. It's easy to see this as a distant problem until it is not. And that is why we will continue to mobilize other countries to join us in making concrete commitments, significant commitments to fight this outbreak and enhance our system of global health security for the long term.
Health officials in Juba have stepped up efforts to ensure the deadly virus does not spread to South Sudan. Armed with thermometers and notepads, a team of health officials have been screening passengers in tents at Juba International Airport. South Sudan President Salva Kiir is scheduled to address the UN General Assembly on Saturday. South Sudan in Focus will carry a live special broadcast this Saturday featuring Mr. Kiir's speech and reaction from analysts and the SPLM in opposition. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a closer look at African women and media. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
should music be taught in schools?
It depends. If there are students who have talent, who are interested in doing music, it's okay they can be told, because you cannot bring up music lessons as a compulsory lesson to all the students. Maybe there are students whose talents does not lie in music line. They have different talents, maybe acting or doing some other thing.
Music is something good. In my schools where I passed through in O level and A level, they used to teach us music. But for me personally, I don't used to participate there, but for some reasons. But it's good for music to be taught in schools, because music now, it's one of the ways of passing information, communicating to the communities. So it's very important.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
We are listening to South Sudan in Focus. A new study by the U.S. Broadcasting Board of Governors and Gallup on women and media in Africa says education and language skills play a big role in influencing which platform women access most frequently. And while daily TV usage for men and women is similar in most places, the same cannot be said for radio, mobile phones, and the internet. VOA's Mariama Diallo attended Tuesday's discussion in Washington on the findings.
The research focused on seven countries in Africa, including Ivory Coast, Nigeria, Ghana, Niger, Mali, Zimbabwe, and Kenya. Keynote speaker Tara Sonnenschein says the results show that the political, economic, and social participation of women in Africa can unleash dividends.
We know that if girls are educated and utilize media and have access to information, they will participate in the political arena, they will exercise their power and leverage in the economic sector, and they will make a huge difference in the global economy.
While Gallup sample sizes surveyed 1,000 people per country, the BBG interviewed about 1,500 to 4,000 people. Magali Holt, the regional research director for Francophone Africa at Gallup, says opinions about media freedom vary from place to place.
Nigeria and Zimbabwe, where attitudes toward a free press are relatively low. Then you have Côte d'Ivoire, which tends to be in the middle. About half of the people think that there is a lot of freedom of the press in Côte d'Ivoire. And then the last group of countries, where with Ghana, Kenya, Mali, and Niger, where a strong majority of both women and men say that the media in their countries have a lot of freedom.
Sanya Gloko, the International Broadcasting Bureau's Director of Research, says daily use of the different media platforms shows differences not just between men and women, but also between countries and platforms. With television, for example, there is virtually no difference in usage between the two genders. She says the reason is simple.
In Africa, if a household has a television, it tends to be a single television household still. Televisions are usually a prized possession and are located in a common room, and hence a lot of television viewing is actually a communal activity.
For radio, she says, there are striking differences in daily use between males and females.
52% of women in Côte d'Ivoire use television on a daily basis, compared to 28% of women who use radio.
Women tend to also lag behind men in frequent internet use, but Holt and Glocal say there are many ways to communicate and engage women in Africa.
If you want to say, well, I want to communicate with women in Nigeria, I think that still is too broad a notion. I would use our data for example, is to target down women in northern Nigeria. I will use a different platform, use a different language. I will use a completely different strategy than if I want to talk to young women in Lagos.
Covering the topics they care about the most is also a must, says Holt. Researchers also talked about introducing vernacular languages as an important tool to open up the media sector. In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Still on African stories, authorities in Malawi are stepping up efforts to crack down on criminal syndicates that are aiding an influx of illegal migrants from Burundi, Rwanda, Somalia, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Malawi shares borders with Zambia to the west, Mozambique to the south and east, and Tanzania to the north. Police records show that many illegal immigrants find their way into Malawi through uncharted routes in the hills of the northern district of Karonga. Amaki Odaka is the station officer at Karonga Police Station. He told VOA that a week hardly passes without arresting some migrants.
Normally, every 2 days we arrest these illegal immigrants entering into Malawi through Tanzania. Last Friday, we arrested 12 Somalians. On Sunday, we arrested 3 Burundis. The day before yesterday, we arrested another 3 Rwandese. And I'm talking now, they have arrested about 4 Rwandese.
Daga said many of those arrested claim they are seeking refuge from various social and economic problems in their home country. Police say the influx of illegal immigrants is a threat to Malawi's security and could introduce the Ebola virus because the migrants are not screened when they enter the country. A brim game has ensued as Malawi's government intensifies its effort to crack down on illegal immigration. Taka said the practice is carried out by criminal syndicates involving local people.
These are Malawians who are not loving their own country. They do hide these illegal immigrants in their houses and sourcing some food to feed them. Some of them has been arrested, but we have a problem with these lawyers who answer the cases on behalf of these who are aiding the illegal immigrants. And some they are on court bail, which means they are still continuing aiding these illegal immigrants.
A leader of the business community in Karonga, Wavisanga Silungwe, contends that security officers are the ones largely responsible for the proliferation of the syndicates.
My brother, don't be cheated. We have got evidence whereby even some of the police officers have been involved in this kind of a deal, all right? And we also have got evidence that some of the vehicles that were caught in Kasungu last year was for an immigration officer. And there was a police officer inside that vehicle. Are you going to blame a driver to say just because the driver is a business person? No.
He cited as an example the arrest in May this year of the officer in charge of police mobile force in Nzuzu City and 3 other officers for allegedly aiding the illegal entry of 25 Ethiopians into Karonga. And on September 4, the state-run Malawi News Agency reported the arrest of an army officer for allegedly aiding the illegal entry of 12 Ethiopians. George Gazbatik is one of the lawyers hired to represent some of those accused of aiding illegal immigrants. He believes the problem is with the law.
In all the four cases that I have handled, all my clients have attended the trial up to the end. And the justice is achieved because they get punishment from the Honorable Court. Perhaps the problem is with the law. Because when one has been convicted of aiding and abetting illegal immigrants, the maximum fine is 25,000 won.
Katsipatike believes the stakeholders should lobby parliament to amend the current law so that the punishment for such cases should be more severe than they are at the moment. Deputy National Police spokesperson Mebon Sefula says the police have embarked on daily patrols in all suspected routes used by the criminal syndicates. She says the effort has led to the arrest of 123 illegal immigrants over the past 3 months. Principal Secretary in the Ministry of Home Affairs, Beston Jisamila, announced last week that the government plans to place more border posts between Malawi and Tanzania. A move, he said, would help seal all the routes used by the illegal immigrants. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blanta.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here are some of today's news headlines with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. President Obama is urging Islamic State fighters to leave the battlefield while you can, hours after the government launched a second round of airstrikes against the militant group in Syria. Speaking to the UN General Assembly today, the president blamed sectarian conflicts around the world for creating a fertile recruiting ground for groups like the Islamic State, which has taken over parts of Syria and Iraq in a bloody, months-long armed campaign. Earlier in the opening session, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called on world leaders to have what he called a frank discussion about the causes of extremism in the region. A Jordanian court has acquitted radical preacher Abu Qatada on charges related to a plot to attack tourists during New Year's celebrations in 2000. Qatada was led under heavy security into a courtroom packed with family and supporters who erupted into cheers as the verdict was announced. The court ruled today that there was not enough evidence against him. And finally, a former senior Chinese economic official who has confessed to taking millions of dollars in bribes appeared in court. Liu Tianan was deputy director of the National Development and Reform Commission, which is in charge of steering the world's second largest economy. Prosecutors say Liu took nearly $6 million in bribes, some in cash, some in gifts, including a Porsche and a Beijing villa. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
And that brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday. We now leave you with the song Season of Peace by WJ.
Now and forever.
So, is that good?
WJ was. The king of Lokulili was.
Season of Peace.
WJ was. Jehu, them said. Kapwana kill it.
We have been listening to WJ and the song Season of Peace. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thank you for allowing us into your homes and cars. We hope you can join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.